Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle says suicide is among the rising causes of death in Black communities throughout Cook County.
There have been more suicides thus far this year in the Black community as in all of 2019. Most notably, we're seeing an increase in suicide among young people.
And scrapping the hybrid model previewed a few weeks ago, Chicago Public Schools now says the school year will start with remote instruction. Crane's reporter A.D. Quigg joins the podcast today with more.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot said CTU kind of threatening a potential strike, which they would have had support from national educator organizations to do, was not a tipping point, but the timing was extremely close. I mean, that strike threat came, you know, Monday, Tuesday. There was some agitating around that. And then, of course, Tuesday night, this kind of pops up.
I'm Amy Guth, and this is Crane's Daily Gist. It's Wednesday, August 5th. When it comes to a professional like your doctor or lawyer, you want someone who knows you well. Wintrust believes you should have the same relationship with your banker, someone you can call directly and know they'll understand your concerns. Thousands of local business owners called their Wintrust banker when they needed Paycheck Protection Program loans. They called, Wintrust answered, and helped more than 11,000 local businesses secure funding. Learn more at wintrust.com/dailygist. Member FDIC. Businesses looking for help in navigating the COVID-19 crisis should check out Small Business Lifeline, a new weekly podcast from Cranes. Every Thursday, the free Small Business Lifeline will offer expert advice and information on accessing needed resources during the crisis. Listen to Small Business Lifeline at chicagobusiness.com/SBL.
This is the Cranes Daily Gist with Amy Guth.
We're joined now by Crane's reporter A.D. Quigg here to talk about some news from CPS. A lot of conversation has been happening around what is going to happen with the school year. What is the latest, A.D.?
So CPS, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, Chicago Public Health Commissioner Dr. Allison Arwady came to the podium this morning and said what a bunch of places had been reporting last night, which is that the school year will begin remote this year and it won't do the hybrid model that they previewed a few weeks ago, which would have had students in school 2 days a week, students out of school 2 days a week, and then one day basically live learning with a teacher when everyone is at home. So they will begin remotely on September 8th and go until November 9th, which is basically the first quarter of CPS's year, and then kind of assess things from there. The reasoning for this was new daily cases in Chicago have been ticking up in recent weeks. The average case rate, the rolling 7-day average that we talk about so much, is at 277, which is far higher than that kind of under 200 number that the city's been looking for. If you're between 2 and 400, you're kind of in the yellow zone, as Dr. Allison Arwady put it today. And when you're above 400, you're definitely in the red zone that has public health folks freaking out. So the city's had a bunch of days of new cases exceeding 300. There was one day exceeding 400 on July 29th. Those numbers are much lower on weekends, but again, that average has been ticking up. So it was a combination of those numbers and also feedback from parents who said, we're not ready to send our kids back to school either. The city denied this, but there was also a lot of pressure from the Chicago Teachers Union, who were starting to take the initial steps to have strike talks over basically health and safety conditions there. There's a lot of worry about students being potential vectors of COVID-19, and teachers didn't want to bring that home to their families, and they didn't want kids to bring it home to their families either.
What is the feeling from CTU right now?
Mild relief, I suppose. I spoke with Stacey Davis Gates briefly last night. This was before it was officially confirmed, but everyone was reporting it. It seemed like a fait accompli, and she said, you know, this is the responsible thing to do. We only have 35 days until the first day of school, and we have a ton of planning to do to make sure students can participate fully in this and go from doing emergency instruction that we were doing from, you know, I believe it was March or April of last year that school went remote. And that was kind of a mad scramble to get under control. She says, you know, we're not an emergency anymore. We need time to thoughtfully plan how we're going to do this. Among those concerns are a lot of students that don't have basic internet access. There are some students that going into the summer did not have devices to actually access remote learning plans. Mayor Lori Lightfoot said CTU kind of threatening a potential strike, which they would have had support from national educator organizations to do, was not a tipping point, but the timing was extremely close. I mean, that strike threat came, you know, Monday, Tuesday. There was some agitating around that, and then of course Tuesday night this kind of pops up. But Gates said this decision should have been obvious to everyone going back a couple weeks, especially as we started to see that over 200 number kind of inch up. And a lot of members were, she said, deeply frustrated that we even had to talk about work stoppages or a strike at this point. Unclear what else there is to bargain over. I'm sure there will be continued agitation from CTU about the kind of demands that they want for themselves and for special education students and for English language learners. Obviously, the strike last year was centered around additional supports for students in schools, nurses, clinicians, counselors, stuff like that. So I would expect them to make some kind of certain demands about what kind of protections and wraparound services that students can access even though they're working and learning from home.
Yeah, that's kind of leading into my next question, and that is, you know, there was a lot of feedback about how things went just sort of in that moment in the spring when we had to pivot to online learning. Any indication about how this round of remote learning is going to be different from the spring, if at all?
Still unclear. It will look different. CPS is saying they hope to exceed state standards for the amount of kind of live instruction that students will be getting every day. The ISBE, the state guidance, is at least 5 hours of instruction a day, 2.5 hours of live instruction. There are a lot of classrooms that will be using Google Classroom to access this stuff. We tried to ask CPS today. The city rolled out a big announcement a couple weeks ago that there would be a big philanthropic push to pay for internet access for families without it. There are a lot of internet dead zones around the city, particularly on the south and west sides. We don't know how many students have been connected since that was announced at the end of June, but that's a major push. I don't think we're going to see sports like we're used to. I know that the district will continue giving out meals at certain locations, and they're also making plans for working parents, especially essential workers who are kind of counting on being able to bring their kids to a physical location every day while they're at work, and also childcare for, you know, kids that aren't in preschool or kindergarten. It's all of these are tough, bad decisions that no one is relishing making at this point. I think from the pediatrician standpoint, Dr. Allison Arbery, who is a pediatrician, said over and over, you know, the value of in-person education is not just standing in front of a teacher. There's social, emotional learning happening. There's the structure of the school day. And a lot of these schools are often the safest places for these kids to go. Losing out on that is a big deal. And I think the district is hoping, I know the city is hoping, that residents here do everything they can to get that case count down under 200 and staying under 200 and perhaps decreasing even more. But they kind of sounded a hopeful note today, too, that this gives them more time to perfect that hybrid model that they were looking for. They can learn more from other districts that are planning on opening in the U.S. and around the world to learn what works, what doesn't. Dr. Arbery said, you know, she has a whole team of pediatricians who are watching for outbreaks at day camps and other gatherings of kids, and those signs are so far hopeful. But, you know, as we know, this virus has only been here for a few months. It's only been studied for a few months. So every few more weeks of research and watching and monitoring helps them learn more about how to do this better once they do get back in schools. We should note that the Archdiocese of Chicago is still planning to do five days a week of in-person education. The Noble Network of Charter Schools, which is one of the biggest networks here, is doing remote. I'm anxious to see the fate of the Archdiocese decision, because they had a somewhat similar plan to kind of keep students in pods all day long, as CPS did on those 2 days. We'll see in the weeks ahead if they plan on kind of shifting course. I believe their school year is scheduled to start at the end of August. But yes, these cases continue to go up, and I hope and expect them to be watching those closely.
And the Archdiocese of Chicago had, there was an option for families who maybe didn't want to send their kids back. So potentially that could be expanded if they decide to shift course.
Yes. When they made their announcement that they were planning on doing 5 days a week of in-person education, they said all parents have the option to keep their kids at home if they'd like, and we will provide an e-learning platform to do that. It's unclear if every school in the Archdiocese will use this Catapult platform that we've been hearing about, or if certain schools will develop their own kind of e-learning platforms. I'll be anxious to see what that ultimate option is. I think chaos has reigned for parents all over the city. I'm anxious to hear from more parents about whether they feel better about this. CPS did a survey of its own parents. They found that 41% of elementary school parents and 38% of high school parents indicated they do not intend to send their children back to school. That's a significant chunk of people who are worried about the consequences. Just 20% of African American and Latinx parents at both high school and elementary school levels indicated they wanted to send their children back to school. So there are a lot of parents who, you know, as much as people struggled with teaching their kids or helping their kids with school, all spring long, there are still parents who are wary of sending their kids back despite the benefits of in-person education. It's a scary time, and there are no good or easy choices.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think when there is frustration that bubbles over in many aspects of the pandemic, things that we've seen all along, it feels like it's just kind of losing sight of, we have to make two terrible choices. They're both terrible. Neither of them are the ideal, but we have to make a choice either way. In the weeks ahead, as we get closer to this and as we go into the school year, what will you be watching closest?
Always the case rates. We've been hearing day after day that young folks in the 18 to 29-year-old range are leading the growth of COVID cases in Chicago and suburban Cook County. Obviously, they are not as high a risk of dying from COVID as other at-risk groups. But the issue is, in the weeks to come, if people do get infected, they can spread it to other people in their household, parents, grandparents, friends of friends. Dr. Arwady gave a presser this week saying, you know, our biggest threat for spreading now is these small gatherings like birthday parties or graduations or get-togethers where, you know, you let your guard down because you're around friends and family and people you trust. The thing to remember is this is not an issue of trust. This virus can spread to people. People can be asymptomatic. And it's not a matter of them hiding this virus from you. It's just a matter of the virus being there and being easily spreadable. It doesn't matter if it's friends or family. You've still got to be aware of what it takes to prevent the spread of this stuff. Keep your mask on. Stay 6 feet apart from each other. Wash your hands. If possible, stay outside. Just staying conscious of how this virus moves. So yes, I will be watching carefully if that 18 to 29-year-old spread leads to bad outcomes in those high-risk categories.
AD Quigg, thanks so much for talking this through today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, a local startup aims to fix the cannabis industry's cash problem. That and more right after this. Chicago Comes Back provides resilient leadership insights to help your business move forward from the pandemic. Delivered on Thursdays, this free e-newsletter features up-to-date information and guidance for Chicago's businesses. Sign up at chicagobusiness.com/Chicago Comes Back. Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle said suicide can be added to the alarming list of rising causes of death in Black communities throughout Cook County. Preckwinkle said during a news conference, quote, "The African American community has borne the brunt of the COVID pandemic, opioid overdose deaths, as well as a surge in homicides."
And today we're here to talk about the alarming rate of suicides occurring among our Black residents. There have been more suicides thus far this year in the Black community as in all of 2019. Most notably, we're seeing an increase in suicide among young people. The youngest victim this year was only 9 years old.
Dr. Diane Washington, who is Executive Director of Behavioral Health at Cook County Health, said to combat the problem, there must be more resources focused on educating healthcare providers in Black communities how to look for signs of suicidal thoughts and more work done to raise awareness and lessen the stigma associated with behavioral health. According to two trade groups that represent factory owners locally, Illinois manufacturers are feeling a little better about their future prospects than they were earlier in the pandemic, but things are still falling short of where they were. And one of the two groups is far more pessimistic than the other. The more downcast view comes from the Technology and Manufacturing Association, a Schaumburg-based group headed by former state senator Steve Rauschenberger that represents roughly 700 small and mid-sized businesses, most of which are in the suburban collar counties. According to that group's latest monthly economic survey of members, 52% are optimistic about business at a national level over the next year, but only 16% have a positive outlook for the Illinois economy. Both numbers are better than they were this spring, but still well short of the 60% and 24% figures at the beginning of the year. The group in a statement says that major pain points are, quote, government regulations and taxes, followed, they say, by a lack of skilled workers. A second group, the Illinois Manufacturers Association, also says that the state's manufacturing economy has competitive issues. Citing federal data, IMA President Mark Densler said that since 2010, Illinois gained just 1,000 manufacturing jobs compared with 50,000 in Indiana and nearly 26,000 in Wisconsin. Densler did, however, praise Governor Pritzker for designating factory workers as essential in his executive orders, a move that kept most industrial workers on the job. Densler added that national trends are at least as significant as what's happening locally, and with manufacturing starting to pick up nationally, some sectors here are feeling optimistic, including those in food, chemical, and automotive industries. The biggest factors right now, in his view, are whether COVID finally comes under control and whether or not a full-scale trade war breaks out with China. Chicago-based Hyatt reported a massive loss during the second quarter due to the coronavirus pandemic, with the company reporting an adjusted net loss of $183 million. According to Bloomberg, analysts were predicting a loss more in the neighborhood of around $137 million. Revenue per available room, which accounts for room rates and occupancy at the hotel chain's properties, was down 89% in the second quarter compared with the same period in 2019. The worst of it came from hotels that Hyatt owns and leases, as opposed to those owned by other investors and simply managed by Hyatt. Revenue per available room among those 37 Hyatt-owned properties was down 97% year over year. Hyatt CEO Mark Hoplamazian said in a statement, there remains uncertainty regarding the full return of hotel demand to pre-COVID-19 levels, adding that the company is, quote, encouraged by some growth demand in China and certain U.S. markets. Hoplamazian's statement pointed to Hyatt's nearly $3 billion of liquidity that would allow the company to operate for another 36 months if demand for hotels were to remain at the same level it was during the second quarter. Hyatt has been able to generate and conserve cash in recent months with a $900 million bond offering in April and an announcement in May that it would cut 1,300 corporate jobs. The layoffs were expected to include about one-third of the people at Hyatt's Chicago headquarters, or about 350 jobs. Preliminary results for July weren't much more promising for Hyatt either, given recent spikes in coronavirus cases. Despite an uptick in bookings from leisure travelers taking regional road trips and staying at its property, the company reported July revenue per available room was down 76% from the same period the year before. In the meantime, Hyatt has reopened many of the hotels that had been closed because of the pandemic. As of July 31st, 87% of its system-wide properties were open, up from 65% at the end of April. That number was lower among hotels that Hyatt owns and leases, where only 69% were open at the end of last week. A Chicago fintech entrepreneur and a LaSalle Street bank are tackling one of the biggest headaches in the marijuana business, and that is that most transactions are done in cash. Spence Labs has built a mobile payments app that allows people to buy marijuana products with their phones, and PharmaCann, a large Chicago-based marijuana grower and seller, has been piloting the app in recent weeks at its VeriLife store in North Aurora. While cannabis is legal in the state of Illinois and in several others, it still remains an illegal drug under federal law. Therefore, most traditional banks and credit card processors kind of don't want to touch it, and they're unwilling to provide services to marijuana companies. As a result, most deal only in cash, which adds security and administrative complications to the business. In fact, safety concerns related to cash are among the most common concerns voiced at community meetings about allowing dispensaries. Spence transactions are processed by Burling Bank, which is a boutique bank in the Chicago Board of Trade building that got its start in 1989, catering to traders, and began serving some cannabis companies about 3 years ago. Rather than being processed as credit or debit card payments, the transactions are electronic payments from the user's bank account, kind of like online bill payments and transactions like that. There are a handful of other companies like that serving the cannabis space with payment apps like Hyper, which is based in Scottsdale, Arizona. And Cresco began rolling out a cashless payment option across 18 stores in 9 states. And that's Crane's Daily Gist for now. Our continuous news feed lives at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks so much to our guest today, A.D. Quigg. Be sure to subscribe to these conversations on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you like to get your audio on demand. And find hashtag Crane's Daily Gist on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Let's continue talking there about these and other business stories. Our show is produced by Todd Manley at Earsight Studios. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll meet you right back here next time.